The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled Cosmology.
Third question of Clement, is cosmology of all things? Now, the most primitive rock carvings in the world, it's getting warm in here already, are what you'll find in the glyphs, whether you go out to Lincoln Beach, used to be a marvelous collection, that used to be a sacred place out there, dancing, there's a cave out there, and of course it has been mercilessly looted. Used to be splendid, splendid displays out there. One big industrialist from New York came out and saw and coveted. Of course, there's a law of 1906, you're not supposed to do that, and walked away with some very valuable ones. Well, anyway, if you look at these carvings, what will you find? You will find glyphs, you will find spirals, you will find swastikas, you will find sun wheels, you will find quadrates, you will find these throughout the whole world. They're cosmic signs. They have to do with the revolutions of the heavens. They have to do with the sun and the moon, and with the cycles of the year and so forth. Not all of them, but they're plainly marked and they are found by the thousands. And if you want to go back to what we call primitive societies, what about their rites and their dances? The very impressive, it'll begin around 15th of March this year, the Hopi dance cycle will begin. But when the snake dance is purely cosmic, it begins, you see, the dancing is done by the antelope clan, and they form the cosmic spiral. They spiral around three times, and when the dance is over, they unspiral. It's the winding up of the universe. The thing is very much aware not only of the elements of the rain and the clouds and the earth, the snakes go back to the underworld, but also of the stars in their courses. They're very important. In the Kivas, particular rites, they observe stars, especially Sirius, but they make special observations of the stars. The Kivas are set up to align and to sight along certain stars. This is just one example, and there are many, because you know throughout the world you find the great megalithic sites. You know what they are, a megalith means a big stone, and you find these giant stone monumental establishments. Put megalith on, because it's very important. I notice anyone as conservative as Professor Edwards, who was here last week, E.S. Edwards, has come around and concurred on that. Remember he said in his lecture on the pyramids, he said they didn't build these things for nothing. Well, they used to think they did build them for nothing, that it was just to display the vanity and power of a king. That was all they did, and they put slaves to work and so forth. That isn't the idea at all anymore. Edward used to hold, he doesn't anymore. He realizes, he says, it was for something, and it all is to take your bearings on the universe. It's a cosmic structure, all the angles and points. They used to accuse people that went too far in that, such as old Mr. Rutherford, we had him visit here a couple of years, become absolute nuts on the subject of pyramidology. And so other people shy off from it. You don't want to become identified with the lunatic fringe. You can carry it a long ways. Nevertheless, the oldest monuments we have, everything we do, are based on our awareness of the cosmos, of the setting we're in, you see. And Edwards recommends Alexander Thom's work. Now, what Thom did, he was a Scottish engineer, who retired and started to take alignments and sites on megalithic monuments throughout Europe and England, and they number thousands, these sites, and find that they do follow certain rules and have a certain standard measure, a megalithic yard, and they have alignments on stars and the moon, and have to do definitely with the equinoxes. They were aware of the precession of the equinoxes of all things, which takes considerable scientific sophistication. And these are borne out in hundreds of places. Well, even Professor Edwards has come around to that now. But the point is that that we've always been aware of this, and this is what our temple is about. Of course, the temple is a place where you take your bearings on the universe. That's what the word temple means. It's a template that you put on the map. Our Salt Lake Temple, of course, is full of that. All our temples are, but especially Salt Lake, where you see the sun and stars represented. And up at the east end, west end rather, you see the Dipper pointing to the North Star, around which all things revolve and the like. And the three levels, everything is to know, the sunstones, the moonstones, the stars, the 3 degrees of glory and so forth. They're very cosmic in its structure. And of course, what's presented there is a cosmic drama of the creation and how things were got going and so forth. It takes us in contact with the real with the real cosmos. And the funny thing is, the Christian year, most conservative Christian year, seen in the Anglican Church, is strictly based on solar and lunar festivals. Of course, you use the calendar, the Easter. The big Easter controversy, which was ferocious and raged for years, was should we judge Easter by the moon or by the sun alone? Because the two don't cooperate very well, as you know. And you have two different standards to go by. But if you do have to judge all your church, we don't have, you see, we don't have the canonical year. We don't celebrate at a certain time, say the first full moon, the first new moon after the equinox and something. This is very important for them, and it has to do with the solstice, because we have all this in temple. This is taken care of there. That's as the ancients used to. But they're following in England and all those other countries, they're just following the very ancient practice, go back to the earliest time. We have archaeology here, a way back journal, big British Journal of Archaeology, way back from the 18th century. We have over 200 years of it here, showing their tremendous concern in England with these things, and that the church years and so forth, they deal with these, are simply continuations of the old prehistoric megalithic rites, go back to the oldest time, on judging all your movements, engaging everything, putting everything into the cosmic scene, which everything is not just a setting, it's not just a sejet, but it's an active, it's a planetarium. It's a thing where things are happening and you enter into it and you cooperate and you move along with things. You see, you move with the traffic. And they're very much aware of this, and this has been carried over. A very good book, I don't know whether you have it here, Hector St. John Fieses, called The English Holy Week Ceremonies, and he traces them all back to early customs. And of course, we have the customs and the folk tales and the things that have continued since, and very early records. Classical writers visiting the country thousands of years ago describe what they did there and so forth. We all know about Stonehenge and the like. So we have our facsimile too in the Pearl of Great Price, which is a hologram. That's one of the best you could find. We're not going to talk about that now. But then you also have science fiction, which is our latest expression of this idea, that to enter into the picture, to be part of it, the cosmos has to be in there. Now, it's a strange thing. They call it cosmism, and it is banned from religion today. You're not even supposed to mention it. This is an interesting thing, because it used to be the whole show. And, of course, this is what the Pearl of Great Price restores with a vengeance. Cosmism. They call it cosmos. We'll put in quotes. How does that look? Oh boy, what handwriting. I write it otherwise. Fancy. No, they say, now this is out. We cannot do this because this is not religious. Is cosmology an inherent part of religion? This is the question that comes up. When revelation is denied, and they talk about deliteralizing and dehistoricizing and de-eschatologizing and demiracalizing and de-apocalypticizing the elements of the Bible. That is, all the supernatural elements in the Bible, we remove them if we want to find the real story, what the real kernel was. We can't, as we noted before, we're above that primitive nonsense. The early Christians may have believed in that, but of course we know better than that. We're scientific. Neary says, if you... we've done all that, we've got rid of everything, we've de-eschatologized and the like, we don't really believe in literal heaven and the like. That means that cosmology will also have to go. But without cosmology in religion, an important ingredient is missing, one which the Pearl of Great Price restores, actually. At all times, the doctors of the Christians and the Jews had driven cosmology out with a fork, just like Horace, but it always kept coming back. They could never leave it alone. The issue of how far the real universe is to be involved in our religions have left the learned sitting on the fence. The problem behind much of the vagueness and difficulty of Hermetic and Gnostic literature is that, of course. The terrible questions would disappear at a stroke, as Lovejoy observes. That's a very important writing. It's not on reserve, but if you can get it, Arthur Lovejoy wrote a book called The Great Chain of Being. And it has to do with what they believed about cosmology in the Middle Ages, and right through. They always believed in a multitude of worlds, and they always believed in the vastness of the universe and so forth. This has always been part of it, and it's the modern world that got rid of it, strangely enough. But Lovejoy, The Great Chain of Being, in which all things are related, It was the most sensational philosophy book of its time at the beginning of the century. But he says, just forget the cosmos, and then all your questions disappear at a stroke. But then all your answers disappear too. No questions, no answers. Nothing to bother about, but this is what we took it up for in the first place, to know are there answers to these questions. Well, now, the favorite source of this cosmology in the Christian religion, it gets in and it stays there, is from Plato's Timaeus, the Pseudo-Dionysius, you won't go into these, and Genesis. After all, it's the physical creation. God created the earth. It was quite physical, whether you like it or not. And they won't let us deny the real universe. And consequently, this is Lovejoy speaking, the language of acosmism, that is, there is no cosmism in real religion. Acosmism just negates the negation of a cosmism. The language of acosmism, he says, is never to be taken too seriously. Nobody really does. It's just interesting because they talk it all the time. One can't simply ignore the universe. As van der Leyva writes here, there's a human inclination, general as well as Christian, to base the trust on one's salvation on the cosmic. Only when the human passion of a divine savior has a cosmic background does salvation seem sufficiently assured. You've got to have it real. It doesn't seem, the way he puts it, erst wenn man die Passion des Heilens einen kosmischen Hintergrund hat, scheint die Seligkeit genügsam verbürgt. Without that cosmic background to underpin it, he says, the idea of salvation is not sufficiently confirmed, verbürgt. It's not strong enough. You need that underpinning because you can't leave that out of it. And yet Werner Jaeger, the great German classicist, whom I knew very well, I used to, because I was a Mormon, it interested me very much, and he and his wife used to have me at their apartment. We used to talk a lot about these things. Werner Jaeger, in his classical work on the subject, he says, as a good Lutheran, that the two do not belong together naturally. In fact, that cosmism and religion are absolute enemies. You can never mix them, because one is spiritual and the other is physical. Here we go on that again. He says, the two do not belong together naturally. It was Plato, he says. He wrote a book on this. Well, his book called Aristotle, the title of the book is Aristotle, Werner Jaeger. It was Plato who converted astronomy. Previously, the essence of atheism was astronomy, imagine that, into the essence of theology. Now, what a thing Plato did. Before Plato, astronomy was the essence of atheism. There was a Sagram's Whiskey sponsored a TV program some years ago in which the leading scientists of the time, I mean the big wheels, such as Shapley, the astronomer, and Kostofsky, the biologist, and Raymer, the geologist, they all got together. The subject was life on other worlds. And the whole theme of the series was that if there is life on other worlds, there cannot be a God. Christianity can't possibly be true. There can't be anything but salvation. See, they were fed up, and they were completely brought up on this idea that creation had to be from nothing or it was nothing at all. And so life on other worlds would discredit all religion, if there was life on other worlds. Well, that's a strange thing to come to, but Jaeger says that was the very essence of the thing before Plato. Astronomy denied religion. Of course, well, it's just the opposite, you see. Kant says, well, what is it which proves to me that there is a God? The law within me and the Christian Himmel Ibrahim. The divine law within me and the starry heavens above me. People look at the stars and say that proves it. Aristotle looked at the stars moving in their majesty and said, now that proves that there is a God. Other people moves in their majesty, look at the same stars moving in their majesty and say, now look, that proves there is no God. Look, they get along perfectly well without God. Look, they are just going on there. That inverted bowl we call the sky, beneath which crawlingly live and die, look not to it for help, for it as impotently moves as you and I in the Rubaiyat. And that inverted bowl men calls the sky, beneath which crawling cooped we live and die, look not to it for help, for it as impotently moves as you or I. So that you can take the very same evidence and prove absolute opposites from it. To one, the starry heavens prove there's a God, to others it proves that there isn't a God. Well, Jaeger said it was Plato, of all things, so naive, so typical of Professor Jaeger. He was writing at that time his great work on, the three-volume work on Egyptian and Greek education called Paideia, and he brought certain elements in which were I said, well, this is very Oriental. This is treated in the Old Testament and so forth. And have you gone into this and this and this particular source? Because there's a lot of interesting stuff there on the same subject. He says, no, he wouldn't touch it. Because if he started bringing that in, though it was perfectly relevant, he admitted, it would destroy the beautiful architectonic structure of the theory of education he'd built up. That's typical German professorship. You abolish anything that doesn't fit into your structure and say, presto, there it is. That proves it so. They do that again and again. They remove every passage from the Bible. They've done this again and again that refers to a physical God. And sure enough, the original Bible didn't say anything about it because we've taken out all those other passages. This is the way we manipulate. Well, Jaeger says that. He converted the essence, cosmology as the essence of atheism into the essence of theology. If when Plato, Xenophon, and Aristotle, and this is Kahn speaking, Carl Kahn, if when Plato, Xenophon, and Aristotle speak of heaven as a cosmos, they do not have in mind the immediate special spectacle of the night sky, still the celestial motions are the most conspicuous and most noble manifestation of what they do have in mind. Of course, the 19th Psalm, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Well, the Greek teachers, Pythagoras among them, according to Cheiremon, a very early recorder, when they were engaged in recondite studies of astronomy, first and foremost was astronomy whenever they were to consider anything. The literalism of Hesiod and the Milesian school, cosmogonies, and it was all of Egyptian inspiration, according to the various sources here, and the Hesiods and the rest. Well, the majesty of the majesty of the cosmos and the clearest evidence of divine order in things was not to be ignored. But if it's accepted, where did it fit into a purely spiritual, abstract, allegorical theology? When, for example, a Dutchman by the name C.P. Van Andel recently collected all the writings of Enoch, the Greek writings of Enoch, and put them together and compared them. What was the original Enoch? And there are many texts, you see, but where they all agree that's the original source. And the thing that bothers him so much is that Enoch's so fond of astronomy. He's bringing it all the time. And to him, he considers that corruption. It must be attributed to separate schools or a different cult entirely. They go together logically enough. And R.H. Charles, our friend R.H. Charles, is disgusted that Enoch even mentions astronomy. He says there's nothing spiritual about that. He says it's the most crass physical science. It's hardly pure astronomy, incidentally. Well, in Enoch, when the Lord says of Adam, he says to Enoch, he says, I appointed Adam as a name from the four component parts, the four elements that make up everything, you know, the four elements. And that's the name Adam, Adam, you see. And I appointed him four special parts and four special stars, and I called his name Adam. The stars, the components, the elements of the body, the colors, the directions, everything goes together. It's all united into a single system. And this knowledge, a special knowledge of the stars, Adam, now we're getting this, you see, from both from the books of Enoch and the books of Abraham, as we have them, not just ours, but of the newly discovered, you see. And he says, the special knowledge was passed to Seth, and from him to Noah, hence from Abraham to the Egyptians. It was the secret of mathematics and astronomy, according to Jewish tradition, accepted by the doctors of the Middle Ages, right down to Thomas Hood in modern times. Now, this aspect of Judaism has a peculiar appeal to the early Christians. This is exactly the part of Judaism the early Christians like. They like this cosmos, you see. It's only the moderns that have got rid of it. They like this sort of thing, and that's why they adopted it, according to some Jewish scholars. That is why the Jewish doctors gave it up, because the Christians adopted it. They didn't want to become too closely identified. And Zed, who writes a lot in the Jewish Revue des Etudes, the Review of Jewish Studies in the early days, he's one of their main scholars. Well, not so long ago, 1964, it wasn't ages ago. And Zed saw in this cosmological mystique of the Middle Ages, the Beraita goes right back to the Apocrypha of the first and second centuries. And it was shared by the Jews and the Christians up to the fifth century, and then they dropped it like a hot potato. They wouldn't have anything to do with it. Strange thing, isn't it? He says, this impulse for cosmological speculation of the Palestine rabbis of the first three centuries absolutely dominates them. And Altman traces it to Plato's Timaeus. They always trace this back to Plato. You don't have to trace it to Plato. People always had cosmology in their religions here. mediated by Philo, who was, of course, a Jewish Platonist, and the Gnostic writers, which produced a special Gnostic, a rabbinic gnosis, we're told. Yet, van der Pleeg, he finds the same cosmological teachings of the Jews already in the Psalms, and of course cites the 19th Psalm, the heavens declare the glory of God, and so forth. And he says the Jews always had that in the early days. Now, modern scholars shun the question of cosmology. It's poison. It only complicates theology, they say. It was one of the crimes of Joseph Smith to bring it in and so forth. They associated it with magic. Now, Carl Schmitt, who at the turn of the century was the foremost authority on early Christian manuscripts, before we started getting all the Coptic and the other stuff, but Carl Schmitt was the man. Well, of course, he edited lots of Coptic stuff. Something that he says it was the cosmological speculative ideas which repelled the fathers of the church more than anything else. They detested them. They loathed them. They fought them savagely tooth and nail. Fathers of the church, mentioned being the 4th and 5th centuries, would do anything to suppress that teaching that the cosmos has anything to do with religion. Isn't that strange? Because it's speculative and so forth. It is the main issue between them and the Gnostics, he says. The Gnostics were guilty of turning purely religious objects into cosmic powers, which gave the death blow to the Eigentümlichkeit of the Christian religion. That is, the genius of Christianity, he says, was the abolition of cosmology. But there was no cosmos in religion. And when anybody tried to introduce it or go back to the old Jewish teachings or the early Christian teachings, they were guilty of the cosmic heresy. They were guilty of being Gnostics and so forth. Apparently, if the Christians taught anything that anybody else had ever taught, they were not original and therefore not to be taken seriously. But I just thought, last hour, there is this objection to cosmology, namely that it could be a dangerous thing. Its intimacy with the cosmos is likely to turn people's heads. This has happened, of course, we have stories of this. It filled us with infinite vanity. See, the people who study the cosmos are willing to accept the divine as long as they are it. Like Longinus, he is the great divine, the great sublime that he depicts. Carl Sagan would be a good example of that. See, he wants himself actually apotheosized, the symphony orchestra in the background, the heavenly light playing upon him as he gazes off into the vastness. Here is the ultimate achievement of creation, right here, you see. And it has that effect. The great scientist of H.G. Wells and so forth, Faust is the classic instance of that. Faust is a disturbing story. He wanted to know. He'd been teaching, he'd studied all subjects, haben auch Philosophie und Juristerei, Medizin, leider auch Theologie durchaus studiert. I've studied all these subjects, heißt Magister, heißt Doktor, I'm a Magister, I'm an MA, I'm PhD and so forth. And yet after this, here I don't know anything more than I did before. I'm as stupid as I ever was. What shall I do? He pulls his students around by the nose and he says, and he can't, not, he's not going to stand this any longer. Drum habe ich mister, I've turned to magic, that I don't have to tell my students a lot of things that I don't know. With sour sweat. This is the object. Dass ich verstehe, was die Welt am innersten zusammenhält, sei alle Wirklichkeit zusammen und tu nicht mehr mit Worten kann. That I can see all reality together, that I can grasp the whole cosmos, and not just fiddle around with the definitions of philosophy and so forth, the things that bothered Clement, remember? The schoolmen could only give him the stuff that Faust is utterly sick of. He's sick and disgusted with it. He says, ich muss kein Hund so lange leben. No dog would live longer like this. He's either suicide, or he's going to commit himself to the higher powers to understand these things. And so he becomes the mysterious Dr. Faustus, who sells his soul to the devil, you see. Knows too much. You mustn't seek to know these things, as far as I go. Seek to know no more, as the witches tell like that. So this cosmology, it can turn your head. When you, the story in the Abraham, in the pockets of Abraham, when he goes up and beholds, well, in a number of ascension stories, early ascension stories, when the hero, in this case Abraham, goes up and beholds the vastness of the heavens, he becomes dizzy, he has nothing under his foot, he thinks he's going to faint, he's going to pass out, he starts raving and so forth. It's too much for him to behold. And again, we have numbers of stories, very early Christian stories, when the apostles ask to be shown Satan and his powers and the great gulf and so forth, the Lord advises them, don't ask to see that. It'll do things to you. So we have this. And is the payoff a wasted life? Faust gets nowhere until he repents and comes back to faith again, this by faith. And also, very much striving just for me and Dinkin of your lazy. The angels say finally, don't give up, keep trying, keep striving, don't let vanity carry away, and you can be saved, as far as that goes. But the famous Dr. Faustus, he was not just on the Rhine, but throughout Europe, he was a great myth, that he was finally able to master all sorts of things. And of course, the earlier Faust is the earlier Faust is Marlowe's Faust, the English Faust, a great play. They're both great dramas, as you know. The great is in two parts. See how Christ's blood, in the end, he says, remember in Marlowe's Faust, see how Christ's blood streams through the universe. One drop of it will save me, oh my Christ. He's looking at the Milky Way, and he gets carried off. But back, he says, this must be the idea of redemption behind this. It must have to do with the gospel plan somehow or other. Meanwhile, they go into all the various purlieus and corners of ancient mythology and so forth to taste all the forbidden delights, etc., to learn the evils of this world, and they find that they're really not much. It's the payoff to wasted life. I talked about 1969, it seems. I gave a talk on this science fiction in the gospel, and it was just printed without my knowledge. I didn't know anybody had taped the darn thing, and needless to say, it's full of things that I shouldn't be there. But because it's like here, and but this, the picture is a good one here. Now let's see. I think on page 13 here, this is the point. That's beginning with the great scientist, the early 20th century, of godlike knowledge and uprightness as a central character. Science fiction soon discovered chinks in the armor and ended up with, in a very short order, with the sinister figure of the mad scientist, either making a Frankenstein's monster he cannot control or deliberately perverting his knowledge for power. The mad scientist became the stock figure instead of the great scientist, which passed away because he was altogether too fantastic anyway. There's one example I think is a good one. There's some wonderful examples here of how they actually considered him. But let's go back to here to some real scientists here. Now, this is by C.P. Snow. C.P. Snow wrote these novels about life among the scientists of Cambridge, you know, in England. And needless to say, I.E.S. Edwards, who was here, who was a Cambridge professor, Cambridge Snow, knew him very well. C.P. Snow was extremely unpopular, he says here, and everybody hated his guts. That's why he writes these novels, which are rather vicious digs at life among the great scientists. Everybody's playing dirty tricks and stealing everybody else's data and so forth. But this is quite enlightening, these passages about the great ones, which we worshipped in my day when I was a teenager here. The tone... Well, here's a quotation from J.M. Brewer's work, Gosek and the Doshis, giving a picture of what... This is written in all seriousness. Now, this is in all seriousness we're talking here. Voloshinsky, the great scientist, smiled indulgently. He towered in his chair as though in his infinite kindness of his vast mind there was room to overlook all the foolish little foibles of all the weak things that call themselves men. I think of Carl Sagan there. A mathematical physicist lives in vast spaces. To him, human beings and their affairs do not loom very important. But we have sort of a Superman here. The nearest thing to him is the figure of Rutherford, who discovered the structure of the atom in the 1920s, and this was sensational. This is what he says, C.P. Snow says about this. The tone of science at Cambridge in 1932 was the tone of Rutherford. Magniloquently boastful, creatively confident, generous, argumentative, and full of hope, science and Rutherford were on top of the world. Worldly success, he loved every minute of it. Flattery, titles, the company of the high official world. He was superbly and magnificently vain as well as wise, and he enjoyed his own personality. Now here, if ever, says the guy here, is the great lovable scientist of science fiction. What more could one ask for and science at such a level. But he enjoyed a life of miraculous success, says Snow, but then something strange follows. But I am sure that even late in life he felt stabs of sickening insecurity. Now this is strange, sickening insecurity in this of all men. And then Snow goes on to talk about the other great Cambridge scientists. Does anyone really imagine that Bertrand Russell, we all know who he was, G.H. Hardy, the great mathematician, Rutherford, we just mentioned, Blackett and the rest were bemused by cheerfulness as they faced their own individual state? In the crowd they were leaders, they were worshipped, but by themselves they believed with the same certainty that they believed in Rutherford's atom that they were going after this life into annihilation. Against this they had only to offer the nature of scientific activity. That would keep up the fun for a while. It's interesting why they're doing it, but its complete success on its own terms, in itself it was a source of happiness, but it is whistling in the dark when they are alone. Then they feel this, you see. They know they're going into nothing. Have the fun while you can. One moment in annihilation's waste, one moment of wine of life to taste, the stars are setting, and the caravan starts for the dawn of nothing. Oh, make haste, make fun while you can. So it doesn't answer it. See, this cosmology isn't going to answer. It's not going to take the place of religion, in other words. The Alexandrian educated Oregon, our old friend Oregon, we always come back to him. He's our pal, he's our favorite. He knows perfectly well that cosmology has no place in the abstract purity of the religions of the schools of Alexandria. But he says it was the teaching of the early church, and his loyalty is painfully divided in this, as in so many other cases. Gregorius Thaumaturgus tells us how Origen first taught him rhetoric. Then Origen taught him holy mathematics, incontrovertible geometry, and astronomy that sets up the ladder to the things of heaven. And this is what Origen taught when he was a teacher himself at Alexandria before he went to Palestine and got into a lot of trouble with the church because he wasn't Orthodox. He was teaching the old Christianity and got all mixed up and they didn't like it anymore. But this is what he taught. He says, see, Gregorius Thaumaturgus, notice his name, Gregorius the wonder worker, because he had this knowledge of all sorts of scientific tricks. He tells how Origen first taught him rhetoric, then holy mathematics, incontrovertible geometry and astronomy, and it's that that sets up the ladder to the things of heaven. For Origen, the seductive beauty of the universe existing from aeon to aeon, as the genuses and species appear and disappear, sanctifies matter itself. We're quoting from Cornelius here. As a means of containing order among the anarchy of the spirits, the order of creatures, species, higher and lower orders, speciation, taxonomy and so forth, that to Origen was the structure of the universe, and it was part of God's plan in his early days. He gave it all up. His ambiguous position is clearly in his argument with Celsus, who was against the church, and he's trying to answer it. If the Lord says, I am not of this world, he says, there must be other worlds. Their nature is hard to explain if we would avoid falling into the idea of a mundum incorporeum, a universe that's incorporeal, it doesn't have any matter. He says, how do you explain it? This is Origen speaking here. In sola mentis fantasia, is the universe just a fantasy in my mind? Is that all religion is, he says? This is a highly unsatisfactory conclusion, he says. Then he says, in his great work on the first principles of the gospel, I don't see how you're to explain it, when the Savior is actually in one place and then another, or the saints go hither and so forth, and some people come down from heaven. Now that calls for physical motion. He says, but the philosophy won't allow it. God is everywhere and so forth, he can't move around, and what are we going to do? Well, he tosses up the sponge. He can't imagine, he said, what another world would be like. Philosophy has denied him the literalism of the early saints, and he has nowhere to turn. And he says, when finally by grace of God the saints shall reach celestial place, then they shall comprehend all the secrets of the stars. God will reveal to them the nature of the universe and so forth, but I will leave it there. So he settles, he compromises. He says, you can't get rid of it, they're there. God's going to tell us about it later on. Well, he never got to be a doctor of the church. He never got to be a saint, the greatest by far of all their theologians, because he taught these things. He wasn't holy enough. Now this is the teaching of the early saints. His own training breaks through at the end of the passage when he plugs for perfect knowledge. He says, purged of all that is physical and corporeal. That's what he wants. Purged of everything that contradicts himself again. He recommends consulting Philo on the subject of all things. Now, Philo, the Jew of Alexandria, who Platonized, or rather Neoplatonized, the Bible. He says you mustn't take these things literally, and so and so. And he recommends, Origen recommends going to the Jew Philo if you want a solution. As in his speculation on the creation, for Origen, the process of history could have, for him, nothing but a symbolic meaning, he says. As a result, it led Origen into insuperable difficulties in Christology, as Florovsky writes in a recent article. His aberrations were, in fact, Florovsky writes, the birth pangs of the Christian mind. They had to make up the scientists, and what we call the Christian mind today, what is taught in all the churches today, except this one, is what emerged at this time. Origen represents the birth pangs. Should he plug for the cosmos, or should he say, as he does in the end here, that we cannot be purged, must be purged of all that is physical and corporeal, and that would include resurrection, as we've seen already. The Christian mind, says Cornelius, to be respectable has to give up cosmology. He's in the position of those Stoics and Atomists with their anthropocosmologies and descriptions of the world in terms of man's functions, according to Bayet. And yet how ardently they both protested against being considered anthropocentric. They are, but they don't want to be taken that way. In the Hortensius, Augustine tells us that his favorite study all his life has been astronomy, of all things. And the reason he broke with the Manichaeans, for 9 years he was a Manichaean, was but they neglected the study of astronomy. They weren't, couldn't be true Christians, he thought. They claimed to be the old Christians. They were a very old sect in Asia Minor. He joined them, was happy while he was there. But he said they didn't put enough emphasis on astronomy. So he left, of all things. In The City of God, he gives us a typical Stoic public school picture of the cosmos. But since astronomy could not save a soul, later on, he has nothing but contempt for it. What good is astronomy? It won't save you, so forget it, he says. He finally settled for abstraction and rhetoric, as we've seen elsewhere. Though the rhetoric, says Father Eggersdorfer, he taught was vain, superstitious, and empty of everything. Well, John Chrysostom tells us, he's the next one to see, that nothing good in the New Testament has any earthly physical reference. It refers to anything physical. Anytime you read anything in the New Testament, he says, that sounds as if it might be physical, interpret it spiritually. Say it's just an image, it's just an allegory, it's just a figure of speech. Never take anything in the New Testament physically, which doesn't leave you much, does it? Fred Hoyle, at the end of his first book, The Astronomer, says, I defy anyone to write three meaningful sentences on any subject without some reference to the physical universe. Well, that's quite a test, isn't it? You can't get away from the physical universe, and yet Chrysostom says, yes, you can very easily by denying that it's there at all, and if anything says it's there, just call it something else. So when we read that God is in heaven, he says in PG 55 here, when we read that God is in heaven, we must not give literal interpretation to such a passage. He's no place. And as we mentioned, Arnold Lund cites Jerome as giving the idea of God sitting on a throne as an example of pure absurdity. Stars do have a claim on our respect, if we follow Chrysostom, for God created them for our exclusive use and delight. Their main use is to guide sailors at sea. That's why God made all the stars. But that's, talk about being anthropocentric, that's about as far as you can go, isn't it? Incidentally, the infantile ideas about the starry heavens, the popular in the Middle Ages that the stars were 14 miles away and so forth, are not the products of infantile minds at all, but the result of a determined effort of the doctors of the church to ban serious cosmology from a place in theology. No wonder they had silly ideas as a result of that. They wanted it to be trivial and silly, even when they turned aside the terrible questions with one-liners. A famous one-liner of Luther, which is from St. Augustine, as you know, what was God doing before he created the earth, making a hell for people that ask that question. According to De Wolf, who is the main authority, the main work, the big work on Catholic medieval theology, he says, the unanimous doctrine of the scholastics from the time of Abelard on was the individual alone is the true substance. Hence, cosmological doctrines were very vague. Nature as such was commonly looked upon itself as being sui generis, with an autonomous life, so that theology had nothing to do with the cosmos. Up to the 12th century, there were those caught by the hesitation of St. Augustine between creationism and productionism, the hesitation of Augustine, like Origen, he couldn't make up his mind. Creationism was everything created suddenly out of nothing, was this, that refers to pre-existence too, or was it all created at once? St. Aquinas has another way out. He says the spheres of the planets were regarded as being composed of a special sort of matter which was radically different from all terrestrial matter. Now, that's a neat solution. Yes, there is a physical universe there, but it has nothing to do whatsoever with terrestrial matter. They're not the same elements up there that we are down here. We're living on a unique and peculiar Earth, and you'd get that from Aristotle, too. Well, the twilight zone between cosmos and no cosmos was the playground of the Hermetics, and the Hermetic doctrines continued to force themselves, as Zeebo says here, upon the minds of such thinkers as John Duns Scotus Sarafina, teaching the doctrine of the sun as a creative mediator in the developments of the cosmos and so forth. Well, with the Renaissance, renewal of astronomy, and religion found it objectionable, Ramus wanted to rid astronomy of the hypothesis of Aristotle and others by which the Middle Ages sought to reconcile the two kinds. Now, John Calvin, who had the great voice in Protestantism, as you know, Calvin and Luther says, no cosmology, get rid of it. Right at the time in the Renaissance when these things were coming out, the discoveries were being made and so forth, and the prospect was broadening, and the universe was being taken in. Very exciting times. For Calvin, the answer was, it's best not to speak of such things at all, things which are... It's unlawful for Paul to speak of them. Remember, Paul is unlawful for him to speak of them. He says what he's talking about is the cosmos there. That's in the Institutes. Calvin is writing here. Since Paul, though he was carried to the third heaven, positively declared that it was not lawful for man to speak of the secrets which he had seen. John Hutchinson's psychotheology seems to provide a coherent and meaningful universe in which traditional God was still the center and the circumference. Well, and there is that new book of Alexander von Coiré's on this particular subject, how the theologians and the scientists handled this in medieval and modern times, right down to the 19th century. Now, there's a recent tendency going on, 1968 here, a number of people writing together, reconciliations of Christology with the cosmic world. The new religion today, they're coming around again. We saw that in all the case of all the others. The early church taught it. The doctors rejected it. Christianity doesn't teach it now. Joseph Smith comes along with it, and they give him a bad time. Then they start adopting it. That's what von Humboldt said. Remember the great traveler and scientist said there are always three stages. First they mock it, then they persecute it, and then they said, well, we knew it all along. We knew it all the time. They'll do that, you know. The same thing now. Lots of churches have adopted the most objectionable things in the teachings of Joseph Smith. They've really gone, the first being, of course, Revelation, the big three, Revelation, Reformation, and not Reformation, but Restoration, and the dispensations. And I mentioned before, I was at a meeting October before last in Washington, D.C., Jews and Christians meet, talking about the temple, you see, and those were the three words that were just kicked around the whole time, the big three, and 15, 20 years before that, any one of those would be absolute heresy. The greatest crime of Joseph Smith was the preach Revelation and so forth. Well, and Restoration rather than Reformation, and the idea of dispensationism is just as obnoxious as cosmism. Dispensationism, they hate that. Well, they did, but they come around to it now. The way is opened when Whitehead declares cosmology is philosophy and not science, because it's the endeavor to understand in terms of the completely general or metaphorical nature of things. Karl Popper now comes out and says, cosmology is religion, and religion is cosmology. If you're studying, you want to know what it's all about, and that's cosmology, because cosmology is going to include everything, not only other worlds, but what's on them, to the slightest detail, so there's your religion. You don't separate them anymore. It's because of its supernatural implications that the theory of Helmholtz, Kelvin, and Arrhenius, that life reached the Earth through space, was rejected by the positivists. It drew science and religion dangerously close together, they say. The scientists wanted to keep them separated too. So when you get the Helmholtz and you get Kelvin and the new mysterious forces of electricity and so forth, and you get mesmerism and you get Arrhenius, the idea that life reached the Earth through space, well, that's bringing religion and creation, scientific creation and religious creation too, close together, and they thought it was dangerous to bring them dangerously close together. Well, John Lear, who's the science editor for for the Saturday Review, he says, man is a message from a star, but it's not yet sure what it means. So, from the religious side also, we learn that our heavenly rest is, of course, a state or condition. one that requires a place also. Just what kind of a place? Does eschatology, does eschatological mean immaterial? Writes a Catholic priest in the Verbum Domini. No, that's not Catholic, that's Trenkowski. The idea of cosmic redemption necessarily brings the real cosmos into the picture. Again, in what sense? Now, here we're writing in the official journal of the Vatican, and in the Verbum Domini here, and Leonetto Redemptio Cosmica. And it says, the cosmic redemption necessarily brings the real cosmos into the picture. Again, in what sense? And so we get articles now on Pauline, cosmic Christology and ecological crisis today. Dimension Cosmos, the Lutheran writing, Eliade, the prestige of the cosmogonic myth. None has gone farther than to reconcile spirit and matter than Teilhard de Chardin, the great Jesuit paleontologist. But even he leaves it up in the air, he says, as if the cosmos had to be sanitized or Christianized before we could accept it. I don't want to keep on this any longer now, but you get the idea, you see. Then, modern Thomist writers ignore his views, the views of Thomas on this subject, on cosmology, declaring them to be not essential. That's a shaky school, a shaky excuse at best. This is a particular Jesuit writing. I was in a Latin seminar with H.R.W. Smith in Berkeley, and all the other members of the seminar, there were almost a dozen of them, were either priests or nuns. H.R.W. Smith being an active Catholic, and St. Mary's, all these Catholic schools being around, and the subject being Latin inscriptions, they all flocked to this particular seminar. And did you hear about Sister Eloise? They say she's a Thomist. They would breathe among themselves a great secret. They say she's a Thomist, as if being a Thomist, Thomas Aquinas, who was, of course, the gospel, was suddenly come to be a great scandal and so forth. Then she'd pass around the cigarettes, Sister Eloise, and everybody would light up and we'd have a good time. Joking. They're wonderful people. But here, the idea is the modern Thomists don't accept Thomas's views. Well, I guess that's so. One can embrace the truly wonderful Greco-Roman reverence for the wonders of the starry heavens. Now, the Rahners tell us, Hugo Rahner tells us here, you can do that and be a good Catholic now, on the understanding that they're only a sign of what is happening on a higher level of reality between Christ and his church, a cosmos in itself which Oregon has called the heaven of our heart. Thus, we're back to Oregon's solution and perplexities. Christ gives light to all the spiritual stars, even as in our earthly light, Luna brings light to the stars. While to our enlightened minds the uniform motion of the stars suggests a machine, to most Greek it suggests a god. The poor things had never seen a machine, says a friend, R.E. Dodds. Well, such is that. How do the Marxists stand on this? This is an interesting thing, too. They talk about the cosmist heresy. They use the word heresy. If you believe, the cosmists insist on the same separation. We must separate universe from cosmos because, of course, you see where they are, actually. It's dialectical materialism. There is only the material. The religion is just opiate. That doesn't really exist at all. So you can't bring the two together. And yet, they react as Darwin reacted when, and as Kant and the others react, when Darwin, speaking in the jungle and so forth, when he views the glory of nature, he is filled with a thrill of religious awe, and he can't shake it. He just feels that there's something more there. This is a very common experience, and this has bothered the Russians a good deal because they're actually very spiritual people. Notice their religion has been their whole life, their whole endurance, with the hells they've had to go through. They will not let their cosmos be tarnished with religion any more than the Christian doctors would have their religion corrupted by the cosmos. Well, then Rudolf Bultmann, here we go. By his unsubstantiated conclusion that the cosmological texts found in Paul are of Gnostic influence, Bultmann did to Paul what the rabbis did to apocalyptic. He purged it of its world view. Michael Neary writing. Jewish eschatology, the Dane M.E. Dahl is writing here, should be taken mythologically, he said. Jewish eschatology, they took it literally. How we take Paul's theology, which does give the answer to those questions, he says, depends on whether we like it or whether we don't like the answer. It's all up to us how we take these things, he says. We don't need religion to cast light on the nature of cosmos, nor on anything else for that matter. A certain type of mentality there is that holds that science is of a limited power, that its ultimate foundation depends on faith, and of course most scientists go along with that, but according to Reichenach, this finds no support in logic, the rise of scientific philosophy, that science is not founded on faith. Well, this gets into science and religion and so forth. What you see is not real. Milton's angelology, Milton was held to be a heretic in his angelology because his angels were too real. They certainly seem abstract and allegorical enough, don't they? And chiefly thou, spirit, that dost prefer before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me, for thou knowest, thou for the first was present and with mighty wings outspread, dove like sacks brooding on the vast abyss and makes it pregnant. What is he describing? A dove, an angel or something? And he appeals to what in me is dark, enlighten, what is low, raise and sustain. He's appealing, but they say his angels are too literal, so we can't accept Milton as doctrine, and people have written numbers of doctors and masters theses on Milton and Mormonism. Even science fiction is forbidden to introduce any religious element. McKenna writes, the students blush and hate me, but it is for their own good. Science is the only safe game. It is safe only if it is kept pure. We must keep them separate. So by introducing the, incidentally, we mentioned the Sefer Yetzirah is the oldest Hebrew book, written supposedly by Abraham. And as Epstein says about it, it's not concerned either with ethic or religion. Its entire concern is for the natural cosmos. The idea that the natural cosmos might be an object of religion, of religious concern, doesn't seem to occur to him or to Carl Smith or Dorrit Charles or the rest. Say there's absolutely no place for it. Well, this has not been a sidetrack. It is right in the mainstream of Pearl of Great Price, as you know, because cosmology is one of the very strong points. This is what immediately attracts Joseph Smith to the papyri. He says they're star charts, they're plans of the heavens and so forth. And they are, indeed. So we're going to get lots more of that. Someday we'll get around to the Pearl of Great Price, but it's all there. See, it's a small book and you can read it any time, and you'll notice all these things are there. And you must compare it with, if you're going to go into all our theological library over here, and we have a big one, you'll see that Joseph was different, and he has really given us something, given the world something it did not have. People don't know that. See, people have short memories, and we count on that. Ministers and priests, they don't study this stuff. They don't go back into them. They don't bother about it. They're interested in their congregations, getting, just as we are, getting them out to meeting, doing their duty, making their contributions, putting in the plate and so forth. That's all they care about. And so, this is a very important lesson, just the same, in this cosmology business.